This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm joined today by Tima Dranotsi and Agnieszka Bienkacawa, co-authors of Illiberal Constitutionalism in Poland and Hungary, The Deterioration of Democracy, Misuse of Human Rights, and Abuse of the Rule of Law, published in September by Routledge. Over the past decade, Poland and Hungary have become laboratories for a new kind of government, proto-authoritarian regimes that still have regular elections, vibrant oppositions, and external constraint from European law, norms and discretion in providing fiscal transfers. Hungary in particular has generated a comprehensive literature attempting to understand the special nature of the Orbán regime. For example, I talked earlier in the year to Andras Karasheni and Gabor Schering about their attempts to categorize Orbánism. In their new book, Professors Dranotsi and Bienkacawa redefine Orbán and Kaczynski models of government as a liberal constitutionalism. By examining Polish and Hungarian history, identity, and Polish legal systems, as well as the influence of European rule of law, they are light on a definition of a new political phenomenon. Agnieszka Bienkacawa is Polish, a law professor at the Nicolaus Copernicus University in Turin in Poland, and Tima Dranotsi is a visiting professor at the law faculty at the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil. She is Hungarian. Welcome both to the podcast.
Hello, Tim. Hello, everybody. Greetings from illiberal Poland.
Hello, everybody. Hi, Tim. We are thrilled to be here talking about our new book. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm sorry for garbling your names. But as I said in the introduction, there have been many attempts to define these regimes with a theoretical framework. What was it that made you dissatisfied enough with these to write this new book?
Exactly. So many labels and expressions have emerged due to the many perspectives scholars have taken to understand the reasons and methods of the Hungarian and Polish democratic erosion. You just mentioned two of the books which you have been talking about here. Constitutional scholars already since the beginning tended to identify the remodeled Hungarian and Polish constitutional systems as authoritarianism and modern authoritarianism. However, when you think about the last 11 and 6 years, you realize that the illiberalization process has been peaceful, gradual, and continuous in substantive constitutional democracies and less severe than in those states like Turkey and Russia, with which scholars compare the Hungarian and Polish events. This contradiction increased our interest, and we assumed that we would better understand the changes if we considered these factors like, you know, peacefulness, gradualness. For that, we needed to study at least 3 more or less neglected aspects of the deterioration, I mean, in Hungary and Poland. The first was the regional context, which is the EU and the Council of Europe, in which Hungary and Poland exist, and the peacefulness and gradualness of the illiberalization process, as I said. We found the second aspect of the deterioration in the constitutional identity of Poles and Hungarians. The third understudied aspect of understanding this kind of deterioration Hungary and Poland face is the possibility of disentangling liberalism and constitutionalism. It is not an unprecedented scholarly endeavor, neither in theory nor practice. Just think about the idea of neoliberal constitutionalism and how scholars describe Israel like semi-liberal constitutionalism, or Singapore like authoritarian constitutionalism, and Hong Kong as mixed constitutionalism.
So at the heart of your book is the concept of illiberal constitutionalism. Can you take us through the concept in some detail?
Yes, thank you for this question. In the book, reflecting on the regional context, gradualness, methods, and content of changes, the tangible differences between Hungary and Poland and the real authoritarian states, and taking a holistic view on different indices, we developed the concept of illiberal constitutionalism. In our view, illiberal constitutionalism is a stage in the process of authoritarianization of the EU member state, which we called illiberalization of constitutionalism. It is done mainly in the post-socialist region that has been hit by autocrat populist leaders in the second decade of the 21st century. They have brought about the deterioration of constitutional democracy and the hollowing out of its components. The gradualness of the deterioration and the embeddedness of the EU law and human rights commitments in the daily adjudication of law have kept these states from turning to modern authoritarianism. This phenomenon constitutes one element of the concept of illiberal constitutionalism. On the other hand, we propose that the normative appeal of the regime for the population could find its roots more in an unbalanced constitutional identity that longs for a charismatic leader than in a particular political philosophy. Consequently, it is also suggested that this appeal could be satisfied by the application of the patchwork of ideologies insofar as they can be invoked by a charismatic leader for satisfying the current emotional needs of the polity. This, in turn, allows the regime to form the constitutive features of illiberal constitutionalism, which are illiberal legality, illiberal democracy, and the third and last element, illiberalization of human rights.
Yeah, you talk in the book about the sort of the external constraints coming from the EU and from the Council of Europe, but Turkey and Russia are both members of Council of Europe. So is it? Do you think fundamentally it's the EU that makes these regimes different, more fettered, more constrained?
Yes, it is. And the particular value that characterized the European development and fit better to the development of the constitutional democracy and by extension to the European Union. The membership in supranational community creates more legal, political, and financial constraint on public power within its member states. Hungary and Poland are member states of the EU, which, notwithstanding its failures, imposes a particular, albeit rather weak, internal constraint on the political leadership in both countries. The constraint is internal, and not like in Turkey or Russia. It is internal, as integration options are included in the constitution of both states, Hungary and Poland and other member states in the regions especially. But it's legally built on the EU treaty that provides for crucial mechanism of the protection of the EU values that are safeguarded by the Court of Justice of the European Union. And for us, this is the element, crucial element for that.
Yeah, and you talk in the book about your concept of European rule of law, all in capital letters, as distinct from rule of law as such. Can you take us through that concept? What is distinctive about it?
Yes, we wanted to assess the rule of law deterioration in Hungary and Poland. So for that, we needed to establish a benchmark. However, the concept of the rule of law is contested, and it is context-related and perspective-dependent. So we tried to develop the term of the European rule of law because we believe that social reality and constitutional changes cannot necessarily be squeezed into our existing set of terms. So, you know, there are many concepts about the rule of law, thin, thick, and procedural, whatever. So we thought that it is not enough for us when we really want to have a look at what is going on in Hungary and Poland in terms of rule of law. So for us, the European rule of law represents a thicker understanding of the rule of law that has emerged throughout history as a common European heritage, value, and principle, which covers the EU and the Council of Europe as well. It comprises a particular political theory which demands the prevention of any arbitrary use of power with all its necessary preconditions and implementation mechanisms. It also means a legally enforceable concept that is present in the national constitutions and the European legal order. Right now, I'm obviously talking about the EU. This is both the European and domestic arenas. The European rule of law requires the domestic law to bear some specific content, which would make it like good domestic law, informed by the political agenda and decisions reached by the EU, intrinsically its member states. It is a limitation on the domestic political decision maker because there is another positive law, so the EU law, that the holder of the domestic lawmaking power cannot manipulate. No domestic populist leader can hijack the EU law and lawmaking process in the same way they might with their national legislation. So once we had the benchmark, which we called the European rule of law, and with this content that I just explained, we could assess the Hungarian and Polish rule of law situation, which we called illiberal legality, which is a nationalistic and over-politicized conceptualization of the European rule of law. It emphasizes, so illiberal legality, emphasizes the instrumental and opportunistic use of the law in both legislation and the application of the law, obviously, at national level. Illiberal legality retains formal legality, which is part of each thing concept of the rule of law, and extends to the application and enforcement of the EU law. I hope that I could have shed, you know, explain it in a more clearer way for you to understand our concept about or the concept of European rule of law.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to, and this is probably for you as well, Tamea, as the Hungarian in the room, but I'd like to focus a little bit on Orbanism. And as you write, you describe it as the temptation of authoritarianism, but not the real thing. Now, unlike Poland, which is a few years away from an election, Hungary's coming up to an election early next year. How confident are you that he has not gone full authoritarian at this stage, and that if he loses narrowly, that he would stand down? Has he captured enough of the state that, unlike Trump, that Orbán could actually get away with it?
Yeah, it is for me. Günther Frankenberg used this expression, temptation of authoritarianism, to describe the Orban regime. He views authoritarianism as a wide range of autocratic practices that create regimes of governance and marks the distinguishing elements of authoritarian constitutionalism. Now we are talking about illiberal constitutionalism, but authoritarian constitutionalism include authoritarian political technology and constitutional opportunism, power as private property, participation as complicity, and culture of immediacy. So in his co-edited book entitled Authoritarian Constitutionalism from 2019, Frankenberg uses the expression of temptation of authoritarianism. And we say in the book that we agree with him. I cannot predict, obviously, what Orban will do if he loses narrowly. But what is sure is that the system will stand and will make it challenging for the opposition to govern, which in turn could give Orban a great opportunity to return in 2026. So full authoritarianism, I think, could mean that he would not let it go. He would not take a defeat, but it would not give him a chance to, as I said, to return victoriously after this 4 year of unsuccessful governance of the opposition. And why it would be unsuccessful? Probably because they would not have enough majority in the parliament to redo all the reforms which this illiberal government made in the last 11 years.
Yeah, and I mean, on that score, he has a disadvantage too, in that even if he wins next year, he is going to lose his supermajority, which is the one thing that has allowed him to be active in constitution making. Do you think that if he wins by a small majority and he loses that constitution making ability, that there could even be a rolling back of some of the measures of the last 10 years?
We don't really think so. As I said, the system is already consolidated. The opposition parties could change it if they won with a constitutional majority, which is unlikely. With a simple majority, the opposition can hardly redo anything, because everything is already done and consolidated. So they must try to govern within the constitutional and institutional framework the Orban regime has created. In this scenario, Orban will probably use the Polish way of illiberal constitutionalism advancement with informal constitutional changes and with the support of the captured constitutional court. We need to remember that it was the scenario when Orban lost the constitutional majority in the past for a couple of months, and the constitutional court helped him with the invention of the notion of constitutional identity of Hungary. And until this notion of constitutional identity of Hungary found its way to the Hungarian constitution, it was an informal constitutional amendment by constitutional interpretation. And this is the tactic or the technique the Polish leaders use, because they don't have constitutional majority, but they reinterpret, or the constitutional tribunal reinterpret the constitution, and so help the peace party to create this illiberal system.
That is really depressing and interesting. In fact, speaking of identities, your chapter on the historic identities of the countries themselves is really fascinating for an outsider. You talk about their unbalanced constitutional identity and a collective victimhood and narcissism and an underlying desire for a strong man. Could you take listeners through that chapter and your argument?
Yes, it was really fascinating to research that problem. And in what we find out, that the unbalanced constitutional identity has been molded throughout Polish and Hungarian history, in which emotional threads of collective victimhood and collective narcissism and the accompanying resentment plus a longing for a charismatic leader emerged. our state or this state of emotion could easily and quickly be intensified and exploited by our populist political leaders. These feelings and the populist politics based on them are why the current populist autocrats emphasize and trigger, and at the same time are dependent upon and currently ingrandalized features of the constitutional identity of Poles and Hungarian. Our leaders, like Hungarian and Polish leaders, have exploited the emotional needs of their compatriots, like Poles and Hungarians, and used different techniques to gain political support for remodeling of constitutional settings. This support seemed to be stable because it originates from a historically shaped value orientation connected with the group identification so widely shared by Hungarian and Poles. These emotions also explain the fact that Hungary and Poland are the most renegade members of the European Union, and why the European Union seems not to be entirely successful in adequately addressing populist and illiberal leaders. Historically, the coincidence of historical moment of unbalanced identity and the emergence of an illiberal and charismatic leader has shown more durability in Hungary and Poland than the liberal constitutional period after the transition. It might be assumed that there is a historically held belief and applied practice that these countries are better run if there is a charismatic leader whose charisma is more important than their ideology. Due to this unbalanced constitutional identity. But for the ideology, we would say that we need more time, and it requires further research and study to establish the basis of this ideology, and yes, to get knowledge if it is it exists or not.
Yeah. Well, one point you make, and it may be linked partly to that argument, is that while both countries have oppositions, the bulk of the population are not strongly opposed. They're basically comfortable in their positions. Do you think part of that can be explained by what you just described, sort of national identity, but also it's because while the EU provides a constraint, provides a fetter on the regimes, it also provides a deep economic cushion for policies that would otherwise be punished by markets?
We think that the population is just comfortable with the system. Consideration of the rule of law and the independence of judiciary, human rights, equality, and human dignity are not the most important factors in their lives. One of the reasons could be in the particular value orientation we mentioned, which features a more hierarchical way of thinking and a high degree of respect of authority. As it is not authoritarian system, illiberal constitutionalism is not oppressive enough to make the people revolt because they have lost a right or an entitlement. When people feel really oppressed or oppressed enough, they revolt. They march on the streets, they do demonstrate. Just think about the abortion protests in Poland last year, or the march of the judges even before. On the other hand, they cannot really achieve anything. They cannot make a change. There is also a certain nostalgic feeling for socialism, which is a kind of being taken care of by the states and the lack of responsibility for our individual decisions. And we think that this is the economic considerations of people. So they are okay with what they have. Financial support from the states, such as tax allowances or the family support programs, which in Poland is probably, you know, this 500 plus program, which creates really dependent voters.
I mean, you point out in the book that the oppositions in both countries have been split until now. That is no longer the case in Hungary. At least on paper. But do you think that this childcare, I mean, that's a nice way of putting it, but this childcare referendum will divide Jobbik from the rest of the parties? And is there any sign of the Polish opposition creating a united front, or is the rise of this former TV star actually dividing the opposition to the Law and Justice Party?
Tim, it's a really good point and question, and it could be, yes, that the opposition is more united now than before in Hungary. But to my knowledge, they do not yet have a unified and detailed electoral and governmental program which they could offer to the voters for the election next spring. They are busy with the pre-election, and they are looking for the best candidate for the prime minister position, which is not a directly elected position in the Hungarian parliamentary governmental system. So for me, as a citizen and as a voter, the problem would not be whether or not the so-called childcare referendum would divide Jobbik from the rest of the parties, but the lack of a coherent program. It is reported that the candidate for the prime minister position selected in this pre-election scheme would say the final word on the program of the opposition. So it means to me that the basis of the cooperation is the person and not principles or values. And I think that now Agnieszka would want to say something to this.
Yeah, so in Poland, United Opposition won the majority in the Senate, and lately in the traditional nest of Peace, Law and Justice Party, at the city of Rzeszów, yes, local government. But they couldn't agree for ombudsman candidate, and they lost media law in the same. The opposition was not united in the presidential election last year. So it may mean that we still have genuine electoral play and competition. But on the other hand, it may be also the issue of looking for a strong autocratic leader within the opposition, because we have many bigger or smaller opposition parties, but they are looking for someone who will lead the opposition, and this is connected with this autocratic leader. And it is the case also in Hungary, and we can say that this is the case in our histories, like Polish and Hungarian history. So this is the situation with opposition.
Just another question on Poland, which is the recent backing down by Kaczynski in his standoff with the EU over judicial reform. Isn't it always going to be his problem? And this applies to both countries, actually, but perhaps more to Poland. Isn't it always his problem that while enough Poles may enjoy a fight with Brussels, a genuine rupture, you know, a Pole exit or a Hunxit, would be deeply unpopular, and the governments there know that, so they will always eventually back down.
Well, Kaczyński may stop for a while and remodel the judiciary, because this is the case, yes. He may remodel the judiciary a little bit to avoid paying fines, for example. Yeah. according to government, some steps have already been taken by the first president of the Supreme Court. The new disciplinary cases will be decided by other chambers of the Supreme Court and not this disciplinary chamber. Even the government mentioned that the disciplinary chamber will be dissolved. And the new legislation on the judiciary will be prepared. But in my opinion, the new legislation most probably will devastate judicial independence even more. So I am not sure that the last step is connected with the pro-European attitude of Poles. We have to remember that you mentioned the Brexit, that Brits were pro-European some years before Brexit, and anti-EU slogans generated the win in the referendum. And this is why we need to be aware of that, and we should be careful with the assessment of the level of popularity of the European Union within Polish population. Now it might be high, but after years of anti-EU slogans, it might be lower.
Yeah, I think maybe the difference, though, is that almost from day one, the British have been net contributors to the EU budget, and Poland and Hungary are net recipients, particularly now with the Next Generation EU budget program. So, I take your point, but argues the other way.
I think that our government may sacrifice some financial support for other reasons, like developing the judiciary remodeling, because I don't want to use the reform, because it is not the point here. Hmm.
And this is from the perspective of Hungary. Orbán is looking for support, financial support from elsewhere too. And another point I would make is that there is a game here which they are playing. This is the pushing the envelope. So they go as far as they think they can go with the European Union, and they back off a little bit, and then the EU is saying that, okay, fine, now I'm a little bit more satisfied. But then at the end of the day, the deterioration keeps continuing, and that is actually bad for the European Union. So as long as they are partner in this game, it is also detrimental for the entire European community.
Yeah, in fact, you end the book, I think it's the last sentence, says you warn that the EU's actions will reveal, quote, whether the whole is indeed greater than its parts, or instead that the chain is simply no stronger than its weakest link, end quote. So how ultimately tough do you think the EU should be with these governments? And if it came to it, if they pushed beyond the envelope, as you put it, Do you think the other EU states should consider creating a union within the union and essentially leaving Poland and Hungary behind?
Leaving Hungary and Poland behind would be the best for the EU, its values and integrity. But it would be the worst for Poles and Hungarians. For now, they are pro-European and do not want to be abandoned by the European nations once again, as they feel to be abandoned historically. I don't think that we cannot afford ourselves to underestimate the power of propaganda. And now the media, both in Hungary and Poland, is in a really bad shape. But we cannot predict the future, obviously. Just answering to this question further, so the EU is not only about values and harmonized or unified legal measures, but also about economic interest and investments accompanied with political considerations. So we think that the EU should decide which is more important for it, which direction it wants to evolve. And when it figured it out, it can start looking for what kind of political and legal ways are the best to accomplish its goal. So I mean, we cannot give obviously a definite answer to this question, what the EU should do. They need to come to an understanding about its own future. And then when they have a vision, then they could find a way how to address Poland and Hungary, or how to try to prevent this situation happening in the future with other member states.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, their continued presence, as long as they continue to behave in this way, makes them an example to others. Do you think there are other EU countries that would be vulnerable to this type of illiberal constitutionalism?
Yes, as we said, liberal constitutionalism could emerge in the member states of the European Union, yes, and in the era of democratic decay, countries that share similar historical backgrounds, emotional traditions, and value orientations as Hungarians and Poles could be viewed as an easy target for populist, autocrat, and illiberal political leaders. So we don't want to name those countries, but want to describe environment or the elements that create this environment and push or create a target, good target for populist, autocrat, and illiberal leaders.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope nobody reads your book as a handbook in how to deliver that.
It was not written that way. So this is the warning. Our book is really the warning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as usual, to finish the interview, I've asked both of my guests to recommend some books of their own. What did you both choose?
Tim, thank you so much for this interview and this opportunity and the invitation to recommend two books to the listeners. And we understand that one should be from our field of expertise and the other should be a personal choice.
But if you can, yeah.
But, you know, we are here, two of us, from with you today from Hungary and Poland. And so we would like to recommend one Hungarian and one Polish author from whom we got a lot of inspiration during our research. And so the first book we would recommend is Poland's Constitutional Breakdown, written by Wojciech Sadurski and published by the Oxford University Press in 2019. And the other is the book of András László Papp, entitled Democratic Decay in Hungary, published by Routledge in 2017, which discusses the reconstituted and the conceptualized relationship between the state and its citizens, because we think that from a professional point of view, if a reader could have a chance and time to read this book together, they would get a really nice and depressing picture about the Hungarian and Polish constitutional history, reality, law, and theory.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for your choices. And today I've been talking to Tima Drinotsi and Agnieszka Bien-Katsoa about their book, Illiberal Constitutionalism in Poland and Hungary. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.